From the City of Angels, near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, The Invisible Crime. Goodbye, summer. Hello, autumn. The year's just clicking, clicking, clicking. Here's what's happening. An Army soldier has been arrested in Kansas after the FBI said he expressed a desire to attack 2020 Democratic candidate Beto O'Rourke, an American news network, and join a far-right Ukrainian paramilitary group. The 24-year-old from Fort Riley was charged in federal court with one count of distributing information related to explosives and weapons of mass destruction. The Iranian leader Hassan Rouhani has landed in New York for the UN General Assembly, but the Iranian leader won't be allowed to see much of the Big Apple while he is here. Iran's president is subject to the same strict travel restrictions imposed on staff at the Iranian mission to the United Nations, which happened in July. Under the restrictions, Rouhani cannot venture far from the UN headquarters, which sit on the East River on the eastern side of Manhattan Island. The U.S. government has granted him special authorization to stay at a hotel, however. Rouhani is due to address the General Assembly and hold a press conference on Wednesday. His visit comes during heightened tensions between the United States and Iran and amid speculation about whether he will meet with President Donald Trump or not. And as you well know, the latest issues, of course, is the bombing of the Saudi Arabian oil fields by the Houthis out of Yemen, they think, or maybe Iran supplied it. They don't know for sure, but that's a big issue. And, of course, Iran's continuing work toward their nuke program. Here's Dr. Jerome Porcy, author of Atomic Iran. Jerry, what's the latest? What are you hearing, my friend?
Well, George, I think there will be no meeting at the United Nations between Iran's Rouhani and President Trump. I don't see any possibility of that. The United Nations will arrange it so the two appear at different times. And with the tensions as high as they are right now, I don't think President Trump is pursuing any idea, neither is Iran, of the two heads of state meeting. So I discount the possibility of that altogether. And I think the tensions are going to remain high, although I do not think President Trump is going to authorize quickly or maybe at all a military strike, and I'm pleased that there will be no military strike.
Yeah, they seem to be really standing back on this one right now. The Saudis are too. I would have thought they might have done something by now.
Well, I think, George, Iran wants war. They want the truth is these economic sanctions that President Trump has imposed on Iran have been very punishing. And right now the mullahs, the religious leaders controlling Iran, are hard-pressed economically within Iran that threatens to destabilize this leadership internally. And that's a positive pressure. War will further destabilize the Middle East and just play to the interests and advantages of Iran, which would like to be appeased to stop the violence. And I think President Trump is wise to not fall into that trap. I've always said, George, and you know, we've been together on this issue probably 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always said that war is not the solution in the Middle East. It's the problem.
Exactly. Jerry, thanks. Let's stay in touch. This story could still get bigger and bigger. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his rival Benny Gantz launched negotiations over a proposed Israeli unity government. And a key politician said the focus was on who would lead it first under a rotation deal. After failing to secure a clear victory in the second election in 6 months, Netanyahu's Israel's longest-serving premier seems to reckon that he can stay in power only by sharing it. We'll see what happens there. Human infections of a deadly virus that's associated with horses has tripled now in New Jersey in just a matter of weeks, and there's evidence that it's spread to 13 counties in the state. The New Jersey Department of Health says 65 mosquito samples have tested positive for the Eastern Equine Encephalitis virus, also referred to as EEE. Sad story over the weekend. Celebrity chef Carl Ruiz, best known for his appearances on the Food Network, died suddenly Saturday. He was only 44 years old. A story that we have in our highlight reel at coasttocoastam.com. Researchers have discovered a hidden continent on Earth, but it's not Atlantis. They found it while reconstructing the evolution of the Mediterranean region's complex geology, which rises with moon ranges and dips with seas from Spain to Iran. It went under about 140 million years ago. Rachel, Nevada, they prepared for 30,000 people to storm Area 51, but the number of visitors that descended on the extraterrestrial town 150 miles from Las Vegas peaked at just 3,000, allowing authorities on Saturday to begin scaling back operations. Nothing serious happened at Area 51, by the way. A triangular craft recorded by the International Space Station's live feed hovering over Earth has led viewers to ask if it's part of a U.S. Space Force ship. Who knows? The United States Space Force ship is a proposed space warfare service branch of the U.S. Armed Forces, which is intended to have control over military space operations. What else is going on in the skies? Let's check in with Stephen Cates, Dr. Sky. What's your report this week, Stephen?
And hi, George. Happy equinox to you and the listeners.
Thank
as, of
you,
course,
sir.
We welcome in autumn 2019. And, George, this is probably some of the best sky observing coming up in the next few months. When we begin with astronomy, Venus, the second planet from the sun, is a most inhospitable place, as many people do know, with surface temperatures upwards of 900 degrees Fahrenheit. But, George, a recent study by astronomers suggests that Venus may have had water on its surface and moderate temperatures, which may have even had some primitive life, but something dramatic occurred some 700 million years ago when massive explosions of CO2 from constant volcanic activity transformed the planet to what it is today, a planet that has a day longer than its year, rotating backwards. And continuing on Venus, George, because it'll slowly start to appear in the western sky as it moves into that part of the sky in the fall, the brightest of the planets that we can see. But a Japanese spacecraft, the Akatsuki, this particular Japanese spacecraft has detected super winds in the clouds of Venus, and they move around the planet the fastest that we've ever seen. They circle the globe there in four Earth days. But in other sky news, George, astronomers confirm water vapor in the exoplanet K2-18b, simply a super-Earth 110 light years from us. But it's more likely that the object does not support life, as no measurable surface is there on that potential planet because it's around a red dwarf star. But, George, finally in the live sky, as we mentioned, fall is in the air. The moon, tomorrow morning, as you look into the sky, folks, just before sunrise, the moon glides past the Beehive star cluster in the constellation of Cancer the Crab. Binoculars are necessary. A beautiful sight. The moon closest to the Earth, George, on the 28th. We call it perigee. And then spectacularly, the dark of the moon or new moon. This Saturday, a good time to see faint sky objects. Dr. Sky always reminds everyone, always remember to keep your eyes to the skies. Email me at drskyshow@gmail.com. And check out this great website that we love. You'll get lost in there for hours. wikisky.org. Thank you, George.
Thanks, Stephen. We'll talk to you next Monday, of course. And a very weird story supplied to us by our Tim Banal at the coasttocoastam.com website. Very strange. The head of the Russian space agency reportedly announced that they now know what caused a mysterious hole that was found in a Soyuz capsule attached to the ISS last summer, but they're refusing to tell anybody about their findings. The 2-millimeter in diameter bit of damage was discovered in late August of 2018 when a drop in cabin pressure aboard the ISS was traced back to the opening, which was subsequently patched with various adhesives by the space station crew. But the Russians won't tell anybody what they think caused it. Very strange. Up next, astronomer, science writer, and one of our favorite guests, David Darling, joins us next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with David Darling, an English science writer living in Scotland. He has a PhD in astronomy, author of a number of books, at least 50, on everything from life in the universe to the nature of consciousness. His website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. It is daviddarling.info, widely used as a scientific research on the Internet for years now. He also composes and plays music with a cosmic theme and has been putting out an album called Songs of the Cosmos, his latest book, Weird Math. David, welcome back. Looking forward to this.
Hey, George. Great to be back on your show.
How have you been, sir?
Not too bad. This is kind of like our annual reunion, isn't it?
It really is. I look forward to it. I really do. It's just great stuff. And you do amazing work too, David. It's just...
Well, I get involved in quite a few different things, I guess. It's just a fun subject. I mean, fun subjects. There's so much and so much new all the time.
It doesn't stop.
No. And more exciting as time goes on with all these great discoveries. So it's fantastic.
I wanted to get your take on the latest story here in this country where the United States Navy has announced that indeed some of our fighter jet pilots chased several UFOs. They don't say they're extraterrestrial, but they do admit they're unidentified, that they have no idea what they were. They couldn't catch them. These things just took off like rocket ships, faster than that. Have you heard it out your way?
Yeah. I actually watched some of the video clips of that. Very interesting. I mean, because it is reliable data. That's the good thing about it. It's on record, reliable witnesses, and unexplained phenomenon. You would have to say you can't explain it away as Venus or or a satellite.
No.
Because it moved in a very sort of controlled way almost. You know, you would have to say it looked very artificial from what I saw. It was very indistinct. I mean, they're just blobs. You can't make out any real features or anything like that, which is unfortunate. But the way they behave, just something sitting there and all of a sudden just zooming off, I don't know of any natural phenomenon that behaves that way. So if this is a general, if it's a genuine external phenomenon to the aircraft, which you assume it is, I mean, these people know what they're talking about. They'd know if it was a reflection on the screen.
That's
or
right.
The radar or something. They know it's something out there. They're not going to be fooled by something as simple as that. If it's an external object that's behaving like that, I certainly have no explanation for it. I'd like to see more data come up so that we can kind of, you know, get a little bit more of a handle on it. But I have to admit, as a scientist, I like to look at things rationally. I don't like to jump to conclusions. I always like to look at the most mundane explanations first. I don't have one for that.
So no.
It is very, very interesting. I like the fact that it's a reliable source, and it is an unexplained phenomenon that definitely deserves further investigation.
And for one of the first times, our government admits that they were chasing something.
Yes, that's true. Maybe they didn't think it was worthwhile before. I don't know. I mean, it is good that they've put this stuff out there because obviously people are going to start to speculate. What is are they our own vehicles? You know, experimental aircraft. Are they foreign vehicles? Is it some natural phenomenon? Probably not. But you know, you can't exclude anything at this stage. The last thing you want to do is start jumping to conclusions that it is sort of an alien spacecraft or something, because that's way down the list that you should be looking at. But nevertheless, it needs explaining. It is something, and it requires an explanation.
We're with astronomer David Darling. David, what excites you about the universe these days?
So much. I mean, the fact is that we don't understand what 95% of it is exciting to me. It's a little bit embarrassing if you're a scientist. You know, we find the existence of dark matter and dark energy, which make up, 19/20 of everything there is in the universe, and we don't know what they are. We have theories, but we just don't know. I find that very exciting because whatever those things are, it opens up new science. They're definitely not something that we already know about. So we know there are things in the universe that, when we understand them, will open up whole new areas of science. And I find that tremendously exciting.
Let's talk a little bit about the things going on in the universe that we understand, that we don't understand. And, of course, let's start with, of course, the Big Bang, David, one of my favorite subjects, because I have no idea what it is.
Well, yeah, exactly. And the Big Bang, we know something about it. We have theories about the early stages of the universe. But what interests me is the beginning.
Yes.
Not the stuff that happened after it, you know, the particles moving out and changing and evolving and stars and galaxies coming. Okay, that's interesting, but we know something about that. We can theorize about that. What really interests me is what was the trigger for it? How do you, if our universe exists today, and if there was nothing before it, how did nothing turn into something?
Exactly.
Philosophical question as well, but ultimately. ultimately it's a scientific question. And if we roll back time to the very beginning, what was the initial trigger? And scientists don't really have an answer for that. You hear you talk about, you know, quantum fluctuations. But quantum fluctuations in what? And who said that there had to be quantum mechanics? Where do the rules of the universe come from? If there was nothing there to begin with, what instantiated those rules? There has to be something that came in the initial moment. And that's what really interests me. That's the everything else is detail, if you like.
Well, and it's the most puzzling, because as I ask myself that very same question since I've been a little boy, how can something originate from what was not there?
Exactly. You really have to have something there to begin with, even if it's just the laws of the universe that tells nothing to become something. And how does nothing become something outside of time? You know, an action always takes time. So if time came into existence at that initial moment, how was any sort of precondition existing that said it had... You know what I mean? It's a really difficult question, and scientists tend to skirt around it a little bit. That's not a criticism. It just means that we need to know more about it. Of course, there could always have been something. That's the other thing. You know, there'd be a sort of eternal sea of space-time waiting to bubble into different universes, and we just happen to be one of those universes. So it's happening all the time. But nevertheless, you know, we're not at that stage yet, and we still have to understand, where did that sea come from? Where did that sea of potential universes come from? So that's the thing that really interests me. It's not the stages, the Big Bang, the explosion itself, all very interesting, and we know something about that. It's what happened at the beginning that is, to me, is the unanswered question.
David, my 90-year-old mother used to say, still does, always was and always will be.
Yes, well...
She may be right.
Look at it. I mean, either the universe is finite in extent and time, or it's infinite. And either way, it's fascinating. That's what's great about so many of these unanswered questions. Whatever the answer turns out to be, it's incredibly interesting, you know. So for me, that's really, I don't think I'm going to find out in my lifetime what this initial event was. Maybe we never will. But to me, that's the one important question about the Big Bang.
Are you spiritual?
Yeah, I'm ambiguous, I guess.
You know where I'm headed with this, right?
Well, I guess, yeah. I know where you're heading with it. You know, because something has to start the universe, right? Something has to be
exactly.
The initial trigger. What created it, you know? I guess. Is that where you're going with it?
I am, yes, sir, because I was going to say maybe a god, whatever it may be. But then the next question is, how did God start?
Well, that's right, exactly. You know, you just push back the question mark in a sense, and then maybe the answer would be, well, God is outside of nature, so we'll never know. But that's kind of unsatisfactory in a way, because if there is a God, and of course, what does God mean? That could mean a lot of different things to different people. Sometimes it's a personal God, sometimes it's kind of a divine force behind the universe or a benign force behind the universe. And then it kind of shades into science more than religion. So there's a whole spectrum of possibilities there. But again, yes, you run into this question of, okay, you're just pushing back the question mark. God somehow, if God existed, had to somehow physically interact with matter and energy to get things going. So there has to be a physical connection at some point, even if it's a divine in nature. So I still think that there's a scientific answer to be found there. But in answer to your original question, yes, I'm spiritual, but I'm not orthodox religion in any sense. I don't choose any particular religion because I can find fault with all of them. I like to sort of generalize it a little bit more than that. I'm a kind of pick and mix kind of guy when it comes to spirituality. But I do have this feeling that there is a kind of a presence, if you like, a presence. And certainly in my personal moments, I turn to that, you know. I can't deny that at a personal level, I have this kind of belief that there's something there, although I have no idea what it is. But I suspect there's more to the physical universe than just the physical universe.
Well, and then as we add in things that you have studied, like consciousness to the unknown, then it really starts getting even more puzzling, doesn't it?
It does, because we don't really understand consciousness, which to us as individuals is the most important thing of all. If we don't have that, we don't exist, you know. And of course, the standard scientific view is that consciousness arises from the workings of the brain, and when the brain dies, that's the end of it. My own personal view is that consciousness is more of a primary property of the universe.
Hold on, David. We'll talk more about that when we come back in a moment. David Darling with us, the astronomer. Next hour, we'll take phone calls with him. He is one heck of a scientist. George Norrie back with Dr. David Darling as we talk about the universe. A couple of his books include The Extraterrestrial Encyclopedia, Weird Math as well. David, how many books now? More than 50, right?
Yeah, it's a shelf full, yeah. It's topping 50, so I'm kind of losing count.
Good for you. Paint us a picture as if we are visually looking at the beginning. What are we seeing, let's say, after it started? Kind of paint us a picture. What would we be looking at if we were on the outside looking in?
Yeah, well, of course, a lot happened in the very first few not even split seconds. We're talking about tiny, tiny fractions of a second, you know, less than a trillionth of a second. A whole heck of a lot happened in that first instant of time. And a lot of it was invisible. So you wouldn't even if you could, you know, be kind of outside it looking at, looking with your eyes, you wouldn't see anything because there wasn't much in the form of light coming off.
Okay.
But you can kind of use your imagination, as it were. Initially, well, we don't know about initially, but something created an explosion, if you like. Now, the Big Bang.
Would we have heard it if we could hear it?
Well, again, you know, you're talking about extreme energies here. So if you want to talk about sound, and of course sound has to have a medium to travel in, you know, in air in our case.
Sure.
But there wouldn't be air. But you wouldn't really have heard anything, although you could imagine waves of something equivalent to acoustic waves, you know, being there. None of it's really within the range of human senses, so we'd have to imagine we've got super senses to see all this stuff happening. There would be a whole succession of particles emerging. Initially, there would only be one type of particle, okay? And then gradually they would split off into all the types of particles that we see today. And all of this happened very, very quickly. It all happened within a split second.
That's amazing, just trying to comprehend that alone.
I know, before the Big Bang, which is kind of what we always think of, this explosion, this hot blast that, you know, the universe has been expanding from ever since, there was a period called inflation where the initial speck that was the universe grew in size by a phenomenal amount, at a phenomenal rate, okay?
With or without light?
Well, electromagnetic radiation was part of that. Electromagnetic radiation is comes from one of the forces, electromagnetism. There's also gravity and the weak and strong forces as well. There's four basic forces in nature, and all of these gradually split off from the one initial force. Okay, so what we call light is really, you know, it includes X-rays and radio waves, as well as the visible light spectrum. That's the electromagnetic spectrum. That's what we can see, the middle bit of that. So there would have been all of that later on. There was no electromagnetic radiation to begin with because there wasn't the electromagnetic force. It was the original force. So that came a split second later. What I'm trying to get across is that most of the action in the universe happened within the first second or so. And after that, it's as it were, history. That's when matter emerged and energy of the form that we're familiar today in the form of the Big Bang. And the Big Bang was the hot explosion that followed these earlier phases, inflation and the whatever the precondition of the universe was. So it wouldn't be visible and or audible into the human senses, but there's a tremendous amount of energy involved. The temperatures, for example, were unbelievable, you know. Absolutely unbelievable in terms of. That's why we have these huge particle accelerators today, trying to recreate the energies that existed close to the Big Bang so that we can investigate what particles were present early on in the universe.
And if we were peering in on it before anything happened, what might we be, and again, this is all speculation,
what would we
be looking at before anything happened?
Before anything, yeah. Well, I mean, if it was before anything, there'd be nothing, obviously, by the very definition.
Well, I wonder what nothing looks like.
Well, yeah, nothing can't exist in a sense, because nothing, you know, that's the opposite of existence, isn't it? There's no thing, there's no time, there's no space, there's no matter, any that can't actually exist, because the very definition of something is that it exists. But to be be a little bit less philosophical, there is another possibility, and that is that our universe is just one of many, many universes. This is the multiverse.
Right.
And all of these universes emerge like bubbles, as it were, from a foam of a quantum sea. So a sort of a primordial space region of space-time from which universes are constantly arising, and ours just happens to be one of them. And that's that sounds crazy. It sounds totally wacky science fiction, but it is actually a mainstream scientific view these days that there are actually other universes out there, and ours just happens to be one of them.
Isn't it entirely possible that we may never find out how it started?
Yes, I think it is, because what would that initial event consist of? I think we can push it back further and further, but I think we're going to have a great deal of trouble in isolating what indeed, if there was ever an initial event. I can't see that happening. I think we'll just get closer and closer to it, but never actually know.
How do physicists and astronomers and people in the know, how can they speculate on the fact that they say the universe is about 14 billion years old? How do they know that?
What if they're
off by 10 billion years?
Well, it's essentially rolling back the clock, so we can see that the galaxies are moving apart, okay, or at least the clusters of galaxies are moving apart today. The entire universe is expanding. And so in a very simple-minded fashion, you can reverse that motion, and you can see that it all started about 13.8 billion years ago. You know, it's just a question of just reversing time, as it were. And we can measure the rate at which the universe is expanding quite accurately. So we can tell in the past that the galaxies and the clusters of galaxies are a lot closer together, and we can tell that 13.8 billion years ago they were all at a single point. That's when the universe emerged. So we can be actually quite specific about when the universe began. We just don't know how it began.
Now, the universe, of course, started about, let's say, then 14 billion years ago.
Yeah.
We are 4.5 billion years. There's a jump start of 9.5 billion years before we started. Before we even came into the picture, what was out there 9.5 billion years before us?
Well, other stars. I mean, some of those stars, of course, still exist today because there are stars that are much older than the sun, and there are also stars that have been born and died in that period. And of course, we now know that many stars, if not most, if not all stars, have planets around them. So there would have been planets around and stars,
and probably life.
And probably life, yes. There probably was life that pre-existed life on Earth, and perhaps even advanced life. There was time for it to emerge in that period, because there were certainly stars around for most of the life of the universe. So it would have looked perhaps a little different than it does today, because everything would be a little bit closer together, galaxies would be closer together. But essentially, if you'd gone back 5 billion years and looked out, you would have seen stars just like you do today and planets around them. And as you say, we don't know, but most likely life on some of them, yeah.
Why does it seem, David, that there's so much order in the universe? It's almost as if everything is a piece of a puzzle and it all fits.
I know. I asked myself this, and of course, what mainstream science will say is that, well, it wasn't like that to begin with. Complexity has emerged from simplicity. There's been plenty of time for things to organize themselves. And when this gets onto, obviously, the origin of life as well, not just stars and things like that, you can kind of explain that in terms of, you know, just basic forces of gravity and that type of thing. You expect matter to clump together to form objects. And so you can kind of get away with explaining planets and stars and stuff like that. But when it comes to more complicated things like life, then you run up against it. And again, that's, of course, another question we don't know. We don't know about the origin of life. Things do tend to get more complex over time, but that has to be somehow almost written into the laws of nature that would happen. Now, there's a couple of ways you could explain that. You could go back to the divine argument and say, well, there's a controlling force on the universe that's directing it in a certain way, you know, and this obviously is the universe by design, and that is interesting if we happen to live in a single universe. But if the multiverse theory is correct, that means that there are billions and billions and billions, possibly infinite number of universes out there, And it's only those in which complexity and life emerges that can even ask the question, why is the universe the way it is? There are many, many sterile universes where that question can never arise. So then it doesn't become a coincidence that we happen to live in one where there is complexity in life, because it's only those kind of universes where creatures could eventually ask the question. So you can get around the design argument. You can also get around it by, just say, well, that's just the way nature is. It just happens to get more complex as time goes on.
When I was a boy, my parents got me a 3-inch refractor telescope, and of course, the first thing I looked at was the moon at night, and that was a wow factor. And then I turned the telescope, David, on Jupiter and saw its 4 of its moons right around there. And that was just unbelievable. But then when I put it on Saturn and could actually see the rings of Saturn with this little telescope, it was absolutely breathtaking. And I was hooked. It was unbelievable.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And I think we sometimes lose that sense of awe. You know, when we get older, we forget to look up at the night sky, even without a telescope, you know, just looking at what we're seeing and just realizing what we're seeing, how far away the stars are, how vast the universe is compared to our little lives here on Earth. And you get that sense of that childhood sense of wonder back again. And I think we need to do a little bit more of that. Just look out into the universe and realize that you're part of this immensity. I think it's tremendously thrilling. It's what still excites me as a scientist. I've still got that little boy excitement inside of me.
Taking out, of course, religion out of the equation, we really can't explain life, why we're here, what we're doing here, what we're supposed to be doing. I mean, it's marvelous, but it's also perplexing. But when you add that in with the possibility of how we started, how did the universe start, life after death, the whole puzzle turns out to be one big puzzle.
Yeah. And I think most scientists are honest enough to say they don't have all the answers, and perhaps they never will. I think eventually we'll kind of figure out how life gets started. We have various theories, and you can actually kind of do experiments and see how complex chemicals arise just naturally from simple ingredients. And you can kind of get like primitive cell-like structures, so you can kind of do a little bit of hand-waving and see how that progression works. But it is not what you'd expect of a universe that started as a sort of a blast of mixture of confusion of particles and energy, that after 14 billion years, we would be here asking how we got here. I think that is a mystery. And I think scientists are too quick to dismiss it. I think it is actually a fundamental question that needs resolving.
If the dinosaurs weren't blasted away by an asteroid, yeah, would we still be here?
No, I don't think so. Something would be here. But, you know, evolution is affected by these random events. Sometimes they're, you know, cosmic events, in that case, obviously an asteroid collision, but there's been obviously internal events as well that have happened that have caused mass extinctions, and then new types of life have emerged. So, yes, the mammals were able to fill the spaces, the gaps left by the dinosaurs and the other large reptiles that basically dominated the land, the air, and the sea at the time. We obviously evolved from the more primitive mammals, and mammals evolved very quickly once the dinosaurs were out of the picture. So there's no question that we, definitely as human beings, wouldn't be here. There'd be some form of intelligence, perhaps, but it wouldn't be in the human form. So we are kind of accidental in that
interesting respect. See, I don't believe in coincidences. I think everything has happened for reasons. I don't even believe in luck. I think we create our own so-called luck. We do it to ourselves.
Yeah. Well, I agree with that to a certain extent. I mean, I think an asteroid collision, you could almost say, it's just one of those things. It just happens. Was it preordained that asteroid would hit the Earth at that time? I don't know. Asteroid collisions have happened throughout the history of the Earth and other planets. I mean, it's just something, there's stuff flying around out there. It occasionally collides.
But as you say, without it, we probably wouldn't be here.
Yeah. So you can look at it as a kind of a chain of events. And, of course, that caused a mass extinction and, oddly enough, gave rise to a creature ourselves, which is sort of causing another mass extinction at the moment. So it kind of caused two mass extinctions.
Yeah.
in a single whammy. So small things, well, not a small thing it is, but a single event can have tremendous repercussions down the road.
What will technology allow us to do, David, in 100 years from now?
Oh, wow. It's hard to know what it's going to do in 10 years' time, isn't it?
You look at
of computers and smartphones and things like
Look what we've done in 50 years. Jeez.
I know. Yeah, I look back to the sort of late 70s, early 80s. I used to work for a supercomputer company called Cray Research, and we made the Cray 1 computer. And
big company then.
On it, and to these big companies and scientific labs, and these things cost like millions of dollars, up to $10 million, you know. And they were these knees at the time; they were the fastest computers in existence. And I sometimes have students for maths and physics, and they're always looking at their phones and stuff. And I say, you don't realize what's in that phone.
Are they still in Seattle? The company,
Cray Research. I don't know what's happened to them. I think they still exist. They were taken over by a couple of times, but they were in Minneapolis originally. That's where I worked for them, was in Minneapolis. I don't know where they're based now. I think there is a company still called Cray Computer. I'm pretty sure the Cray machines are still put out there, but I sort of don't know what the chain of events was. I'm not sure where the headquarters are.
I think
they're
in Seattle, Washington.
And it could well be. I have to check on that.
Go ahead, David.
Yeah, I was just going to point out that a smartphone today, you know, has about 1,000 times more memory than a Cray 1, which cost, let's say, and is about 100 times faster. So you're effectively carrying the entirety of the world's computer power back in 1980 in a single smartphone.
I believe that.
People use it for sending mindless texts and looking at cat videos and stuff. They don't realize they're carrying around in their pocket.
Your smartphone has more power than they had on the Apollo missions.
Oh, far and away.
Amazing.
A pocket calculator has more power. I think it was like 64K or 128K. they had memory on that, you know. There's nothing at all. So it's amazing the amount of, you know, the way they got that thing to work. It was fantastic, you know. But people do not realize the extent, the speed at which computer technology evolved. It's phenomenal. It's mind-blowing.
Well, they say it doubled every 2 years, didn't it?
Yeah, exactly. You know, so, and it's not stopping. It's just continuing, but without people realizing it, because it's so easy to use. You go back, you know, to the 1970s, you had to program everything in Fortran or BASIC or something, you know, line-by-line code it all. You had to be really careful about how much memory you use because you didn't have much memory. Today, it's all done for you, you know. It's all pretty pictures and just press this button and press this button. So it's very easy to use, so we don't realize the power that's behind it.
What do you think a black hole is?
A black hole is a region of space where light can't escape, basically, where the gravitational field, the pull, is so intense that a light beam can't escape from it. So it has basically a surface called an event horizon. Once you go beyond the event horizon, you can't get back out again. And we think there's at least two types of black hole, one that forms from large stars after they've exploded. The core collapses to become a black hole, a stellar black hole. And then we also know that there are supermassive black holes at the center of many galaxies, if not most galaxies. There's one at the center of our own galaxy. And that's interesting because we took a photograph of it recently, or at least the stuff that's around it. You can't see a black hole, obviously, because it's black and it's a hole. But you can see material that's in its immediate vicinity that's orbiting around it or falling into it. We're pretty sure they exist. We don't really know what's inside them, you know, what goes on once you fall beyond the event horizon. That's kind of where our equations break down.
And can you come out the other side of it?
Well, that's one possibility. If it's connected by a wormhole, like a wormhole, which is like a tunnel through space-time, then that it could emerge. But that's almost like a speculation on top of a speculation.
Hold on, David. We're going to come back. We'll talk more about your work in the universe, and take some phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM.